This is an interview with Mr. Mackey, M-A-C-K-E-Y.
Yes, Horace Mackey.
Horace Mackey at the Locomotive Engineers. Mr. Mackey, could you go over the what you remember of the introduction of legislation on the Workmen's Compensation Act in the province?
Yes, Mr. Pickett. In the early days, there was no compensation act, but in the year about 1900, 1901, the railway groups were about the only ones that were well organized in the province of British Columbia. Mr. Matt Crawford, at that time being the chairman of that board, applied to the, at that time, premier, Sir Richard McBride, and in regard to workmen's compensation. And in the year 1902, the following act was passed. The act is called the Workmen's Compensation Act 1902, and it was passed on the 21st of June 1902 and became effective on the 1st of May 1903. It was stated as a statute of the British Columbia 1902, Chapter 74. The coverage was limited that it covered employment in or about a railway, factory, mine, quarry, or engineering work, and to the employment by the undertakers as in hereafter defined, or in about any building which exceeds 40 feet in height, and it is being constructed or repaired by means of scaffolding or being demolished, or on which machinery driven by steam, water, or other such mechanical power is being used for the purpose of the construction, repair, demolition thereof. The definition of a factory is fairly wide, engineering work somewhat limited, and railway and mines are pretty well covered, as expected. Well, you'll understand that this was really the inception of a railway group at that time. Other groups were not well organized, therefore with no representation from them.
No, but none from the miners either?
The mines were not well organized at that time either. Miners, better not for business, the miners at that time were looked upon as wobblies like the...
I see.
With respect to the benefits, there was a 2 weeks qualification period. A workman received 50% of his earnings up to a maximum of $1,500. The dependents of a workman who was killed received a sum equal to his earnings during the 3 years preceding his injury, but not exceeding $1,500. So that was the limit that a widow could receive from the death of a man at that, under this act. A workman had the right to elect to either claim compensation or take proceedings against his employer, but the employer could only be liable, apart from workman's compensation, if the accident arose through his personal negligence or willful act. There was provision to contract out of the act if there was another scheme set up with approval of the employer and the workman, and also approved by the Attorney General. In case of disputes, they could be settled by arbitration, and if not, then a single arbitrator agreed by the party or appointed by a Supreme Court judge, and his say was final. Now, later on, it was found when organization became more spread over British Columbia that there should be something done in regard to a Workmen's Compensation Act for all workers. So the government was approached, and they agreed to a committee being set up. Brother T.J. Coughlin of the Trainmen's Organization was appointed to represent the railway groups. J.H. McBeatty of the International Organizations was appointed to assist representing the Trades and Labor Council, which was at that time purely International groups.
Could you spell the names out?
I beg your pardon?
Could you spell out the names?
Well, I did.
They're on there, I think.
They're on there.
Just spell them. Coughlin is what? C-O?
C-O-U-G-H-L-I-N. Thomas Coughlin.
And what about McVitie? How do you spell
J-H McVitie. His name was James Hackett McVitie.
How do you spell McVitie?
M-C-V-E-T-Y.
Yeah, so we have
the right
spelling.
Went to school with him, and we sat in the same, used to be two of us together, sitting in the seat, and he and I sat together on that.
You did?
Yeah.
So you knew him for a long time?
Oh, I know him well. He was a machinist with the Canadian Pacific Railway, and later I think he became president of the trade, or secretary of the Trades and Labor Council during the strike of 19. Anyway, he lost his position with the CPR and went strictly into the labor movement. That was McVitie. Well, now, I might read you, as I have right here, the report that Brother Coughlin made at that time. And it says, I have the honor to report as follows. The draft bill that was introduced at the session of 1914 was made as a basis for an act that was to have its final adoption at the session just passed. And in order to have a fair and equitable act, the government appointed a commission in the fall of 1914 to hold sittings at different times in the province. Also to travel and secure first-hand evidence in the various states of the United States. The provinces of the Dominion, and most of the representatives are employers and employees in the numerous places visited, as well as to meet the representatives of the employers and employees in this province. And it is only fair to say that this commission did their duty efficiently and satisfactorily to all concerned. The report shows, from the report of the commission, a reviewed draft bill was submitted to Parliament. Well, it should be to the Legislative Assembly. It was while this draft bill was under consideration that the Joint Committee, composed of all the classes of labor in the province, did their most efficient work, as we had to combat the united efforts of the employing interests, as well as the casualty insurance companies who wanted to right this business. And when you consider that we had to meet the objections of several associations of employers who averaged two deputations a week interviewing the government, is easy to see what we had to contend with. Now, I might say that I draw your attention to the fact that in the United States, most states are covered by casualty insurance companies, whereas in British Columbia, these people were enabled to get a proper act, which was admitted by a Workmen's Compensation Commission. What our representatives have not been in vain, the act has passed on May the 23rd, 1916, and testified. Without going into detail of the work of our Joint Committee, I cannot in passing refrain from commenting on the very good feeling that prevailed between the members of the government, cabinet officers, and ourselves, and also the sincere wish of the Premier, Honorable W.J. Bowser, to secure the best Workmen's Compensation Act anywhere in the world. Now, as to the Act itself, I wish to state its operation and the rights of the workers under its terms. First, an accident had happened to a workman or working woman, as the case may be, who comes under the scope of the Act. A person is entitled to medical aid as provided in Section 21, except those persons who come under the subsection of Section 4 of 21. This, in my opinion, is not equaled in any Act in the world. True, the workmen contribute 1 cent a day towards the maintenance of this expense, but any additional expense must be borne by the employers, as it is taken from the accident fund. If the accident has disabled the person for 3 working days or less, no compensation other than medical aid will be paid. But if it disables a person for more than 3 days, then all time will be paid, less 3 working days. The accidents are classified as temporary total disability, permanent total disability, permanent partial disability, and death. Also in the same connection, many industrial diseases be classified by but we tradesmen are not classified as belonging to an occupation from which of necessity an industrial disease arises. I wish now to state here briefly the terms of the Act in reference to our particular occupation. Suppose one of our brakemen meets with an accident which lays him up for more than 3 days, and suppose he is earning, say, $20 per week and is off 10 days. With this injury, he would, in the case, be entitled to $11 compensation. That is 55% of his wages. But if he met with an accident where he lost a limb and could not follow his occupation of brakeman, his injury is classed as partial permanent disability. And let us suppose his average earnings are $100 per month, and when he first injured, it is for a time total disability, as he would not be able to work for some time at any kind of job, then he was entitled to $55 per month, and if he was paying 1 cent per day for the medical aid, would be entitled to come under the conditions of Section 21. And if he was not contributing 1 cent a day, he would be under some medical association or system acceptable to the board, so that the medical aid end would be taken care of in any event, and he would continue to receive his $55 per month and medical aid until the time as he was unable to, was able to do something for himself. And let us suppose that when he was fitted with an artificial member, he could only secure a job that brought him only $50 per month or $600 per year. Then the board would pay him for life $2,750 or $330 per year to make up the balance of what his 55% of his wage would give him and what he was capable of earning. But another fact must not be lost sight of, and that is that the brakeman would, say, in 1 year be a permanent conductor, and his probable earnings would be greatly enhanced. Then this fact would be taken into account by the board in arriving at his probable earnings. A case cited above cover temporary total disability and total partial disability. But in the event of injury being such that he was permanently totally disabled, he would receive 55% of his average earnings for life. And in case of death, the compensation as provided for in Section 15 applies. And in the event of marriage of the widow, Section 16 applies. In Section 18, a provision is made that is in no other act that I know of, that is compensation for facial disfigurement. So also is a new departure in subsection 4 of section 15, where payment is continued in the case of an invalid child until the child ceases to be an invalid or dies, or all dependents are included in the act, even though they are aliens and may never reside in the province. To us railroad men, the best condition in the Act is the elimination of individual liability of each railway to the men for accidents, as the railways have to pay their share into the accident fund of the board, and the board pays the injured person direct, so that there is no inducement for a railroad to have their men waive their compensation under pressure of their claims department. And under the Act, it is unlawful to do this. Neither can it be assigned or taken away from the injured person for any cause or by process of law. No compensation for lump sum can be made without the consent of the injured person when the impairment of the earning capacity exceeds 10% of his earnings capacity at that time of the accident. The notice of the accident required by the injured person, or in the event of death, by his dependent, is set forth in section 42, so and no extended comment is necessary, as this section speaks for itself. In conclusion, let me say, I repeat, that we have on the whole the best Workmen's Compensation Act in the world, as most of the other acts have of a time or money limit beyond which they do not go, while ours is for life, and our waiting period is only 3 days, while most of the others have 2 weeks waiting period. It has taken us a long time to get this act, but when you look at its terms and conditions, I believe you will agree that it was time and money well spent. When we look back over our efforts in the past with such acts, and also our experiences of common law with its surrounding causes for non-suit, and when damages were awarded, the major portion was absorbed by lawyers, I feel I am on a safe ground to say in advance that the act will be a great boon to the injured person, as he will get all that is guaranteed under the act without litigation of any kind. And what is so essential to an injured man is proper first aid, also all subsequent medical aid. The common justice, I must give the government all due credit for the passage of this act that is so essential to the well-being of our workmen and women.
Signed.
I must thank my associate officers of sister organizations who work so consistently and unceasingly for the passage of this act, and I cannot close without mentioning in particular the intelligent, loyal, and efficient work of Brother J.H. McVitie, Machinist Union, who above all others we can thank for the good legislation it is my pleasure to report to you. And I must also testify to the intelligent and fair-minded manner in which Mr. A.V. Pinio, chairman of the commission, conducted the sittings. He paid a great tribute to Jim McVitie. That was the representative of the Trades and Labor Congress, which was part of that committee. Well, now, where do
and
we
this
go?
This is Mr. McLaughlin, right? McCoughlin.
Coughlin. T.J. Coughlin.
Yeah, and this is a report to the
that was his report to the railway groups, you see.
Yeah.
He was chairman at that time of the... We have a group, you see, as I tell you, of five or six organizations which are organized on the railways.
Could you mention them again, that once they were represented there?
Well, the group he represented was the Brotherhood of Railway Locomotive Engineers, Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen and Enginemen, Brotherhood of Railway Trainmen, Brotherhood of Order of Railway Conductors, the Brotherhood of Maintenance of the Way, Order of Railway Telegraphers. Now that was the group that Mr. Coughlin represented on this commission set up at that time.
You got any comments on that?
I mean,
were you in on this too?
Well, I was only a member of another of this committee, of the Brotherhood's Locomotive Engineers Committee. Mm. At that time, I was not chairman. Mr. Matt Crawford was chairman at that time. We have a group which meets. The engineers meet themselves and they appoint a chairman. You see. We have a representative in each division in British Columbia. Now, our group consists of, we have 13 members of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers who meet triennially and appoint a chairman. Well, the chairman is the man then that works with the central group, which other groups also appoint a chairman. Now, at that time, I was not chairman, but from 1930, I was chairman of the Locomotive Engineers in British Columbia.
And so you weren't in on the actual presentation?
I wasn't in on this commission. I wasn't part of the commission. But neither was Mr. Matt Crawford. We only didn't have a chance to overweight the commission, you understand. There was only five members on that commission, if I remember that, that really traveled over the whole of the United States and Canada. It was a lot of money that was expended by British Columbia at that time. Now, Mr. Bowser, he became well acquainted with the labor movement because in the early days, in 1901, he was a lawyer that came out here from New Brunswick, and he started in business here. And the first was a young lawyer here in British Columbia. The first income tax was placed on the in 1901, and the railway men, on account of work not working like other people, were only where they only worked in those days a regular day. Of course, a regular day in those days was 12 hours. But our men worked from 12 to 24 hours at a stretch, and we figured that if the railway group figured that they should not have to pay income tax on excessive hours or overtime, which would be overtime. So they engaged Mr. Bowser at that time to forward their cause, and he appeared before the Privy Council in England. And that is how he became well known to the labor group, and after he became, when it was approached his government, he was quite reconciled to the fact that something, he became well known to the labor group, and he felt that something should be done for organized labor. So that is how he became ready to put this act into effect. I might say that Mr. Bowser's government went out after this government was in effect, and the Mr. John Oliver had the right to appoint the commission. At that time, Mr. Wynne, a lawyer that had been a lawyer for the mine mill and smelter workers in Rossland, was appointed as the chairman of the board. Mr. Parker Williams, who was a member of the mine mill and smelter workers, was appointed as the labor representative on the board. And Mr. Hugh Gilmore, who was the representative of the Watrous Engine Company, was appointed as the employer's member of the Workmen's Compensation Board. That was the first makeup of the work to apply this act. Mr. Wynne carried on through the years until such time as he was superannuated. And I think in all times he was very, very fair. And he did not carry, his idea was the human side of workman's compensation and not the legal side. While he was a legal administrator, he always was willing to look at it from the humane point. And I think during all his term of office, and also his successor, Adam Bell, we had wonderful cooperation from those gentlemen as representatives of labor.
Well,
that, as far as we now, what do you want to know further?
Well, what about what other legislative?
Well, we could go.
Briefs. What were some of the most important ones that you present?
The most important briefs that I see was social welfare for women. In the early days, it was impossible to get any assistance for women. I might cite that in the early days, if a woman was left widowed and she had a son, he was forced to keep for. And that caused a lot of dissension, and it afterward has been taken up. The social, now at the present time, women can get social assistance, and that irrespective of their children, they're not loaded onto their children. Next thing is deserted.
When did that come up?
That came up in about 1900 and about 1944, I guess, somewhere about like that. That is that we did not have to have, it wasn't compulsory for the son to maintain the widow.
And
that is the widowed mother.
Were you in on that?
Yes.
Can you tell us anything about how?
Well, that was in one of our briefs at that time, you see.
Yes.
And we got the government to agree to that. Previous to that, I might say that we had a case that I exemplified. It was a young man that had just been promoted to a locomotive engineer on the E&M. And his salary was only $2,400 a year. Now, his mother happened to become widowed, and she applied for some kind of assistance. There was no assistance, but they would not grant her it. They compelled this young man to keep his mother, and he had already become a young married man, caused a lot of dissension in his family and everything like that. Another case where one of our, I might say that was one of the executives of one of our big companies, and his mother and father became dependent. They were old people, and he was saddled with their keep, and it caused a lot of dissension in this. And these cases were brought to our mind, and of course we presented it in our briefs, and we were able to get the government then to relieve those people of that.
That was the coalition government?
Yes.
And
that was...
How did she go about this? Do you remember anything?
I beg your pardon?
Is there anything that worth mentioning about how you went about it? Or
well, the only thing we went about it with in presenting our brief and then showing those people how unfair it was. Now, I'm going to tell you, we had the most wonderful cooperation, as far as I am concerned, from all governments, you see. I have dealt with them all, with Mr. Tolmie, Mr. Oliver, Mr. George Hart, and Byron Johnson. All were very, at all times, were ready to listen to it. And I must pay a great tribute to Mr. George Pearson, which I think was one of the greatest men that, in regard to labor in British Columbia. He was always ready to listen to us and try to do something for the working man. He's a wonderful credit to this country.
Did you have any dealings with the Soviet government at all?
I beg your pardon?
Did you have any dealings with the present government?
No, I relinquished this job in 1948. I haven't been active as a legislative chairman since 1948. I was retired, you see, in 1945. And then, of course, in 1941, I was appointed on the Regional War Labor Board for British Columbia. And I sat all through the war as one of the representatives on the Regional War Labor Board. And of course, I was retired from active service on the railway at the age of 65, in 1945. So not a young man, you know.
No, that makes you born in 1880.
I was born in 1880. That's when I was born, February 27th, 1880. So I'm not a young fellow, you know, by any means.
Now, you were born in Vancouver, were you?
No, sir. I was born in London, England.
London, England.
Yes.
When did you come here?
When did I come to Vancouver? In 1889. Mm-hmm. I went to school here. That's where I got my education here in Vancouver.
And what about, do you remember anything about trade unions then?
Trade unions? There was no such thing as trade unions in those days. I can tell you about the first inception of the trade unions. Maybe that they shouldn't go on record.
Well,
there.
I think.
But,
it would be interesting.
Well, I'll tell you. My father was in business here in Vancouver as a contractor under the firm name of Mackey and Brennan.
Mm-hmm.
And they had contracts for several buildings in Vancouver. One of them was the People's Theater that was being built on Pender Street, and several other big ones, the buildings. At that time, the carpenters were getting a wonderful sum of 25 cents an hour, working 10 hours a day. Now all these contracts that these gentlemen had taken were based on rates at that time. All of a sudden there was they sprang on the contractors that they were organized from now on, and their rate would be 50 cents an hour. Likewise,
when was that? Remember?
Well, I think this was in 1898.
Either 97
or 98.
Well, we can check back.
Hey?
You can probably find the date.
I think
we can probably check back and find the date.
Yes, well. And they sprung this on the contractors. Well, of course, these major contractors also had contracts with plumbers, bricklayers, everybody. At that time, everybody organized. Eventually, practically every one of these gentlemen had to go bankrupt, which they did.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my first inception into the labor movement. And it didn't go very strong. My father then returned to England and went back to, he was an engineer in the London County Council. Went back there, resumed his position in the old country. So that was the end of that. Of course, when I went into the railway business, I realized that we had to have organization, which we had.
When did you go into
the railway?
Yeah.
In 1899.
Which railway?
Canadian Pacific Railway.
I see.
I worked for the railway, Canadian Pacific Railway, for 47 years.
And which union did you join?
I beg your pardon?
Which union did you join?
I joined the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen first. Then the Brotherhood, then afterwards, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. And I ceased with the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers. I was their representative of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers from 1909 until 1948.
What do you remember of the highlights of the history of the union?
The highlights?
Start, for instance, when you joined, what was it like?
Well, of course, conditions were very, very crude. We didn't have employers were not always ready to meet us. Very hard to get a meeting with them. But as time went on,
as far as the railway groups were concerned. I think the railways realized that they couldn't get along unless the groups were organized. They could then go and talk to the representative. The representative carried it to his men, and he practically, if he went along with it, the men went along with it. That's the way it was in the early days. So you might as well say that the representative, the labor representative at that time, it was just as necessary for the employer to have command as it was for the groups to be organized.
Now, did you ever go on strike?
Never.
Never?
Never.
How is this? Why?
Because we, in the early days, we were negotiated. We never took a strike vote before we went to ask for negotiation. As far as negotiation is concerned, I've often been in Winnipeg or Montreal for 3 to 6 months negotiating. But eventually, we didn't always get that which we asked for, but we always made a settlement that was satisfactory to our men. Now, of course, in this day and age, it's altogether different. As I notice in the trade labor movement today, they take their strike vote or feeling in regard to a strike before ever they start to negotiate. Now, in the olden days, we didn't do it that way. We first went, the last resort was always a strike. We have taken strike votes, you understand, but we never had to use them. It was only just a test, I think, by the railway to find out whether our men were behind us. When they found out that our men were behind us, then we didn't require to go on strike. I have never been on strike in my life.
And how you started off working long hours, 24 hours a day, you see?
Well, when I first started here, the day was a 12-hour day on the railway. Everything was regulated to a 12-hour day. When I first started firing, I fired a switch engine here in Vancouver Yard, and I worked 12 hours every day, and we used to change shifts, and on Sundays, we worked, every second Sunday, we worked 24 hours to change over from the night shift to the day shift. Now, of course, on railways, there's no such thing as, in the early days, there was no such thing as tying up on the road. Later, we got legislation, that is, in our contract, that we could tie up after 15 hours, being 15 hours on the road, as we could ask for rest on the road after 15 hours. It has since that been reduced to 12 hours. Now, our men really practically have to work 12 hours today on the railway before they can tie up for rest. So while you might say we have an 8-hour day, it's based on an 8-hour day. Yes, we are required to work 12 hours before we can obtain rest.
So you still don't really work 8 hours?
We do not work 8 hours. That is, we have an 8-hour day. We're paid on the basis of an 8-hour day. 8 hours for 100 miles, or 100 miles pays the equivalent of 8 hours pay. If we make 100 miles in 2 hours, we still get the same pay as we would for working that for the 8 hours.
And you didn't have anything like pensions or so on?
We had no pensions in the early days. Pension was, later years, it was a pension that Canadian Pacific Railway in the year 1903, I think it was, had a gratuitous pension. That is to say that they agreed to pension their employees off at a certain time. We paid nothing to it.
Was this in your contract?
No, it was never in our contract. Yes. We have no contract with, in none of our contracts is there any mention of pension. Our pension is separate. That is on the railways.
What are some of the big issues you bargained on?
Well, in the early days, we had to, our men had to have perfect eyesight, 20/20, and perfect hearing. In the year 1909, the company brought out a rule that men would have to, that could not come up to standard, would be dismissed. So in 1909, the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers, that were very badly hurt by that on the system, they asked their international organization to grant them a certain grant here to put through a visual and acuity test. Mr. Cobb, the general chairman at that time of the Canadian Pacific Railway, Mr. Stone allocated $10,000 to him to put this through. By his efforts, all men that were taken out of service on the railways were put back to work, being allowed to wear glasses. Anybody's eyesight could be brought up to the normal by wearing glasses were allowed to work. That was the first time that glasses were allowed to be worked, to be people were allowed to use glasses to bring their eyes up to standard.
What year was this?
1909.
And did you have to bargain for this with the company?
We had to bargain with the company. This then we had to bargain and get a law passed by our legislative group to allow us to work to use glasses. Now nobody was allowed, even soldiers weren't allowed to wear glasses in those days. Everybody, if they had a standard vision of less than 20/20, you were just out on certain jobs.
And your legislative group got the law passed?
I beg your pardon?
Your legislative group.
Our legislative group, the railway groups, got a legislation passed to allow for a visual acuity test. That is to say that, and that is law today. You can get a copy of that from the Dominion government. Now that is to say that to the acuity for busmen, all come under, anybody that's by run under the railway commission have to come up under the visual acuity test. And afterwards, of course, it has become a well-known fact that glasses can bring anybody up to standard. Our motor vehicle people agree to the visual test as outlined for railway men.
In other words, what this law meant is that if you could see with glasses, you were just as good as without glasses. Is
just as good. That is to say, a railway man, the law went to say that you had to carry a pair of glasses, so that if one broke, you would have another pair to put on. And all railway men have to carry two pair of glasses if their eyes do not come up to 20/20.
And did you have any trouble with the companies on this?
I beg your pardon?
Did you have trouble with the companies on this?
Well, the companies took our men out of service because they couldn't come up to the standard. We had 70 men out of service on the between Montreal and Vancouver.
We had one man in Vancouver here, and he was used to show how a man's eyes could be brought up to standard, because we had that man fitted with glasses, and we got him a job on the fire department here. His name was Howard Ferguson, and it was exemplified that if he could drive a fire truck here in the city of Vancouver, which was shown by pictures to the government at that time, if it must be all right for him to run any kind of vehicles or even a locomotive, which they went along with. I was just trying to think of the senator, or he became a senator afterwards. I think it was Prier, but I won't be sure. But he took a very active part with us. And a Dr. G from Winnipeg was one of the doctors that was hired by our group, and was mainly instrumental in getting railway men to be allowed to use glasses.
Did you have any, were there any other big issues that came up?
Any which?
Any other big issues that came up in bargaining?
Well, of course, all issues were large for bargaining when you come to figure on bargaining. Every issue was a large issue. There's no, when you go to bargain, every issue is a large issue. Of course, lots of things that they call conditions. Conditions were very poor in early days. Conditions have been wonderfully improved in all classes of labor. And they were issues that were hard at times to bargain for. Meals away from home, sleeping accommodation, all those things were hard to bargain for. In the early days, you know, when a man went out to a job, he carried his blankets on his back, you know, and he slept on a bunch of straw or something like that. I'm talking about all labor, not only railway, but other. But all those things have been improved by bargaining. When I go back to the woodworkers in the early days, their conditions were something fierce in these camps in British Columbia. But they have made wonderful strides. And now, instead of it being in the olden days, people used to have to go to work and carry their blankets on their back. Today, why, you don't. You go out and live under proper conditions. But those are things that over the years have been hard to negotiate.
Were you in the negotiation on these things?
On negotiation on these things? Oh, most decidedly.
Do you remember any... is there anything you remember about?
Well, I remember
that you think is important.
I can remember in the early days that we, as railroad men, we were very dirty, you understand. We had coal-burning engines, and conditions weren't good. When we would go into a town, even the hotel didn't want you because you weren't clean. There was no place to wash up or anything like that. You went to a hotel, they didn't want you. I know a condition where men had to would go into Kamloops and had to sleep on the banks of the river because the hotels didn't want you. And that's the way conditions were until such time as things were bettered.
Well, could you
and it was exactly, I'm not only talking of railroad business, but I'm talking of generally, if a man went out to a camp, they didn't think anything of him, you know. A man that was a sailor, went on a ship, look at the conditions there were in those days. Organized labor is the only thing that has bettered all these conditions. If you look at what men were on ships and the conditions that they had, even on our coastal ships here in early days,
why people today can't realize why they we talk about, I shouldn't say that, Jimmy or Banks, but he did, has done the most wonderful thing for us, irrespective of how he did it. He's done the most wonderful things for men on ships, and we find that all the way through the piece.
And this is just a gradual battle, chipping at it.
I beg pardon?
This is just a gradual progress.
Yes.
Bit by bit.
Bit by bit. And we didn't get it all at once, you know. It's been a fight all the way up to get this, you see. People, employers didn't realize that we would have these things. No employer that I ever knew of volunteered any of this.
Never did.
Never did. In the war, when they wished labor, and labor was hard to get, then they did offer conditions to try and pirate employees from other employers that had them. That's why the regional war labor boards were set up. It wasn't so much the workers, it was to keep the employers from stealing the employee from the other man.
By bettering conditions.
It didn't better conditions.
No, but it was set up to prevent employers from bettering, from stealing other people by bettering conditions?
Well, by increasing wages.
That's right. So, would you say that the effect of those boards then were, or the purpose of them was to keep wages where they were, more or less?
It was to keep prices and wages in line. I have quite a lot of stuff on, I have a little bit of that on that, but the Regional War Labor Board did keep prices in line and helped out the depressed conditions of certain people that could not have obtained anything any other way than by the Regional War Labor Boards. I think we made more advances in labor under the War Labor Board than we did at any other time.
Well, how about telling us about your...
Hey?
How about telling us about your service on this board? You were on it, weren't you?
I was on it from its inception until it... I'm very sorry that I destroyed those two, because there's so much on that, but I have a few little clippings here. And then I was later on the Reconstruction Council, which